Tape 8452, House Committee on Judiciary, Friday, June 8th, 1:30 PM, Room 350, Full Committee Work Session. House Bill 2298, Senate Bill 356, Senate Bill 616, Senate Bill 329, and Senate Bill 893.
House Committee on Judiciary, attempt to order the clerk of notice members present to balance their excuse. First item on the agenda for work session is House Bill 2298.
Yeah, I got some amendments. Pursuant to your request.
Pretty standard suit there, Norm.
One more person says that, I'm gonna start wearing these every day.
Yeah. I'll wear my purpose.
That'll end this session real soon. Let's see. Hand it up for everybody. The only concern I see in these amendments is this, that, I think in many, many cases, the bargain struck between the landlord and tenant will be just the general one, where the space is and what it's gonna cost and the general rules. And I think generally, the form agreement that's gonna be placed in front of the tenant is going to include elements not in the bargain. So I think in almost every occurrence, paragraph A, or well, the preparatory language, does not constitute a modification of the bargain. That'll almost always be violated. But, you know, you might wanna go with it anyway.
Is there a motion on that?
Pass the law, everyone will know it.
Representative Frommer moves that House Bill 2298 be amended per the proposed amendments entitled 6779, House Bill 2298. Is there discussion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know that anybody ever said this, and I think when Representative Lombard or someone else brought this up at the last hearing. But there is almost a paradox in stating that something that is refused to be signed shall nevertheless be in effect. Because when you read the operative language, well, I guess it's the preparatory language here that suggests that, number one, anything that's in a statute is automatically in effect. And secondly, anything you previously agreed to is automatically in effect. And I don't think we may have a contract that could last longer than a year, and it has to be in writing to be valid, to be enforceable.
I think we have a representative.
Just in time.
And I guess the bottom line on it is I'm not sure that this does anything at all, as the committee administrator suggests.
Doesn't teach you to get belated.
The spirit of the law is what this states, I think, already, without it.
Well, what will happen is that you'll get people fighting against each other, landlord against tenant, and the tenant will always say that the written agreement contained clauses that he never agreed to. And then get a swearing contest, who knows how it'll go. Because if, by some miracle, the written agreement only contained those things that the person agreed to,
Why wouldn't he sign it?
Who knows why he wouldn't sign it?
I'd like to hear. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Smith.
I think that the underlying purpose of any language, which I do support, is simply to get persons who probably should have written agreements to enter into those written agreements. That's the good public policy. But this language somehow disturbs me that if you refuse to sign a written agreement, it shall nonetheless be an agreement.
Well, there's another out. It probably won't get past the Senate Judiciary Committee, so you could pass it out and let them.
Go.
Well, yeah. I don't know that I can get anybody here to agree with me on this, but it's been nagging at me down deep.
Well, one part of the effect, I would think, would be that there are probably maybe a little bit of an advantage for the landlord with this kind of language, because you're gonna have the written agreement there, and there's not gonna be any question about what the written agreement is, whether it's signed or not. But then there's gonna be a real question as to whether or not that was the bargain of the parties or not. And I don't know. I'm not very enamored of the bill,
well,
period.
Mr. Chairman, there's one thing that's left out of this. Maybe the written agreement could contain the original bargain.
But it's oral.
But maybe if it serves any purpose at all, then by offering it to the tenant and showing him what's in it, and the tenant refuses to sign, the tenant's going to say then and there, no, this does not contain our original bargain. I don't know. It's disturbing to me. The original policy, I believe in this language, I'm not comfortable with.
Remember that the bill has two sections, and that Section 1 appeared to be non-controversial.
Section 1
of the bill. That's the elimination of the word thereafter.
I agree with that. I agree with the principle this is trying to reach.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fromar.
What if we just had subsection B of this amendment without attempting to say that there's a bargain when there wasn't one, but cut off the tenant's right to sue for the landlord's failure to have presented the proper written agreement?
That's innocuous because only the most bizarre tenant would sue for $100 to get a copy of an agreement he refused to sign. He'd get tossed out of court right away.
Well, I'm not sure that that's true.
You are a landlord, then.
I've been a tenant.
I hear mine laughing over here.
I don't use written agreements either. I have
anything for the list?
Smaller tenancies than that.
I see. Is there further discussion of the motion? The motion is to amend House Bill 2298 per the amendments that are distributed by staff.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me for being tardy. What is the objection of Representative Smith? Maybe he would enunciate it. I know you're uncomfortable with the language, but in what way?
I don't disagree with the policy we're trying to achieve, but it does bother me to write into statute that a written contract that is offered to you to sign becomes operative even if you don't sign it. But there's just something that flies in the face of reason when you have that in statute.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cohen.
Could you refresh me, please, someone, on page 3, subsection 4, if we do not accept the amendments, are we still left with subsection 4 in the bill?
No, that's been deleted.
That has been deleted by now. So we have all of section 3 is out and subsection 4 is out too.
Well, sub 4 is the...
It's a controversial.
This is the amendment to sub 4.
Right. Mr. Chairman.
Everything after that's been deleted.
Excuse me, but I'm saying if we don't accept the amendment, we're still left with this current subsection 4.
No.
Yes or no?
That was deleted, and then we tried to get some new language.
Okay,
sub 4 is
out. It is out.
Representative Hughes.
Have you considered simply dropping A?
Mm-hmm. That'll be my next motion after this fails.
Mr. Chair, if I remember, the original purpose behind this, as it was stated, was that the mobile home parks are required to have written agreements, and I'm not quite sure what the penalty is if they do not, but they're required to have it. It seems to me that the converse of this proceeding would be simply, number one, the tenant shall not have a cause of action pursuant to subsection 2 as Representative Frommeyer may move, and secondly, is that the only provision relating to the mandatory written contract? Relieve the owner of having to have a written contract. If no one will enter into one, then he's relieved of having that responsibility.
I guess you could even get into a situation where the landlord could refuse to give one, and then that could be then bar the tenant's suit to get it. That's recruited, how circuitous this could be. Really, what you should do is just not let them move in until they sign the agreement.
But the problem is the people that have been there for some period of time already, and you're going back to them now for the first time. They mistrust signing an agreement. They have no idea what's contained in the statutes that they're subject to. And I can understand, particularly in a retirement mobile home community, where there'd be some reluctance to enter into these agreements.
Isn't that your district?
I have a number of them in my district.
Better vote right.
Okay, further discussion on the motion.
I've got all the help I need right out here.
I assume do you want to go through with it?
Sure.
Okay. Those with opinion that the motion should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Cromer?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Smith?
No.
Yugas?
No.
Cohen?
Aye.
Gardner?
No. Fails.
Chairman?
Representative Cromer?
I now have the same motion but deleting paragraph sub A and renumbering or rewriting accordingly.
Okay. Representative Frommeyer moves the proposed amendments with the deletion therefrom of sub A. Is there discussion? Representative Smith?
I've got to raise a question. Maybe Dennis can help me. Where is the requirement that says that they shall have a written agreement? What statute is that?
It's
91875, and yep. This is a subsection under that.
Yeah, it's 875.
Concerned about the debate that Dennis and Representative Frommeyer started about whether it's innocuous or not to have this provision.
May not be.
Further discussion on the motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Frommeyer?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Yugas?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Gardner?
No. Pass. Okay, is there a motion on the bill as amended? Representative Frommeyer moves Council 2298 as amended to be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chairman, excuse me for a moment. Is the bill off the table?
Should be, because
I believe it is.
Okay.
Is there discussion?
Just a quick moment. I presume all the rest of the amendments apply.
Right, except for sub A.
Mr. Chairman,
could
I have no more than a one sentence nod or approval or disapproval from our witnesses?
Okay. Are we happy?
Yeah.
Okay, if the landlords are relieved from the, if they won't sign the agreement, they're already there, then we told you we're happy. The other section was suggested by Representative Lombard, and that's approved.
The idea that it's not compulsory,
I took
it over to the attorney.
He
didn't like the same thing he did.
But
the idea that if
they
didn't sign it,
it was
still in effect. He thought he'd have a lot of fun with that.
Okay.
The question is upon Representative Frommeyer's motion to Council 2298 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Frommeyer?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Richard?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Hugh?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye. Passes.
Yeah. Next bill on the agenda is work session is Senate Bill 616.
This bill relates to exemption from serving on a jury. Present law contains a list of occupations which automatically exempt a person from jury versus a benefit. Within that occupation includes doctors, lawyers, veterinarians, chiropractors, etc. The other day, when you consider this bill, an examination of whether all the per se exemptions should be replaced by a more general rule, as in the state of California. And I prepared language which is suggested as a way of enacting that general rule. The language would be, and I might as well read it, the court shall, instead of may, shall excuse a person from acting as a juror upon a showing of undue hardship or extreme inconvenience to the person's family, the person's employer, or the public served by the person. In applying this subsection, the court shall carefully consider and weigh both the public need for juries which are representative of the full community and the individual circumstances offered as a justification for excuse from jury service. Please feel free to criticize, change, whatever, but I think that captures what you were trying to do the last time you considered this bill.
Include.
Representative Bugis.
Why shall it still be? I don't see that much difference. I wonder if it sounds like a mandate, how you interpret every bit.
Yeah, my thought in drafting that was that if the showing were made of extreme hardship and inconvenience that overweighed the need for that person on a jury, then force the court to let him out, because the testimony was that, let's say, the pharmacist came in and made a pretty good showing, and the court, at least in the case known to that pharmacist who was testifying, of course, that's too bad. That's too bad. You're going to have to serve anyway. I don't care what it does to your business. We need a jury.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Richards.
For a purpose of discussion, I'd move the proposed amendment to House Senate Bill 616.
Representative Richards moves Senate Bill 616 be amended per the proposed amendments entitled 6559 as distributed by staff. Is there discussion? Is there objection?
Objection.
Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Richards?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Bugis?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Brunmeier?
Nope.
Lombard?
Nope.
Mason?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye.
It passes. Representative Richards? Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate Bill 616 and Grossi Floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Richards moves Senate Bill 616 as amended be sent to the floor, printed and engrossed with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fulmer.
I'm not sure how we'll vote on this measure on the floor, although I do intend to vote against it now and serve notice of the possibility of a minority report so that I can talk with the person who first put in the bill, because it is so totally changed from the intention of the sponsors that the sponsors may not have any desire that their name be on it, or that they be identified with the fairly dramatic change in policy that it represents. I think over a long period of time, the language that's proposed by staff and just adopted by the committee is certainly the ideal public policy. But whether it would be administered much differently from the policy which now exists in the statute and which seems largely to have been ignored, it seems to me is enough concern to raise these objections that I think.
Okay.
Yeah, my objection likewise is simply, I think, a matter of speed and timing at which we accomplish the ultimate end. I do agree in what we want to ultimately accomplish. I think, as I said the other day, however, this has come out of the fertile imaginations of the Judiciary Committee and has not run the muster, the gamut of the interested parties. Tell simply by the great number of people in our audience today who are obviously here on other bills that we're slipping a good one by them.
Mr. Chairman.
Maybe no.
Representative Richards.
Mr. Chairman, I really feel that if the jury system in this country is to be strengthened, that we need to take this very positive public policy step and open up jury service to those select professionals who have now enjoyed here previously an exemption, and just support the bill in its present form, and would note for the record that one of the sponsors of the bill sits on the committee with us.
Further discussion. Representative Bugis and then Representative Smith.
On behalf of 1/9 of the sponsors, I think it's a very gutsy move.
You're a flighty little guy.
But that's right. Maybe we ought to think about it. I'm going to vote for it. Yeah, I'm going to stand by my decision. But before the bill moves very far out of away from your long arm, I think I'll talk to a few of the see what chance it has on the other side in the present form.
Okay.
For the purpose of making just a little bit of a record, since we're all kind of authors of this now, with a couple of exceptions, how would the showing be made of the hardship, would it be made possibly by a phone call to the clerk of the court, followed by a letter of confirmation from the person seeking the exemption, or is it going to require our pharmacist to close his shop and go down and spend a day in a large jury panel until his name is called and then explain it all to the judge?
You'll have to decide for yourself. I don't know.
Sure. Personally, Mason.
I think that, we should allow the courts a degree of informality, and if indeed this policy can be implemented by a letter, and that satisfies a presiding judge or the appropriate judge in the district, I think that should be allowed. I think that, a lenient policy like that could perhaps be abused, but I'm going to assume, and I think rightly so, that the members of the judiciary that will implement this will do so with a great amount of prudence, and I'd like to see the informality preserved. And until proven otherwise, I think it should be, or until it's shown the necessity otherwise, I think we should allow an informal implementation of this by letter. I think the phone call is a little bit too informal.
Well, I said phone call followed by a confirming letter.
Phone call followed by a confirming letter should suffice.
Mr. Chairman.
Professor Richards.
I think, too, that we're going to see, just as we do now, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, differences in application of the law, moving it to the local discretion of the local judiciary.
Further discussion. Motion is to send Senate Bill 616, as amended, to before the due pass recommendation be printed and addressed. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Richard?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Dugan?
Aye.
Carlin?
Aye.
Bromar?
No.
Lombard?
No.
Mason?
Aye.
Carter?
Aye. Passes. Okay, next item on the agenda.
Give notice of filing possible minority report.
Give that notice also.
Okay. Representative Bromeyer's and Representative Lombard received notice of possible minority report on Senate Bill 616.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Richards.
May I carry the majority report?
I'll talk to you about it later.
Okay. Oh,
Mr. Chairman. Jim, the record reflects that my colleague on my left has got a sign here trying to influence my vote on that bill, and the sign says, no guts, no glory.
So
I voted for it.
Next bill up on the agenda for work session is Senate Bill 329. Dennis? Joan? Whoever says it. Representative Lombard?
Which one? Oh. The old downhill.
The old downhill. These are all wax.
Good stuff. Disappearing. Lost it.
Oh, thank you.
You're going from bad to worse. That language.
This is our bill.
That bill.
Do we have to wait to get notice of minority report?
I was moved to table this 15 hours.
Is this fair to call this the old disappearing lawsuit trick?
Briefly, the background, the reason for the bill. Several years ago, in Vermont, there was a lawsuit entitled Sunday versus Stratton Corporation. It was actually decided by the Supreme Court of Vermont on June 6th, actually last year, 1978, which involved a skiing accident in which the skier allegedly was a novice skier going down the slope, hit the tip of the ski into a bush, became a quadriplegic. The jury awarded the skier $1.5 million against the ski area. Now, attorneys will tell you, in a close reading of the case, first of all, was very poorly tried and probably would have been a good case of malpractice against the defense attorneys. But secondly, even then, it was probably correctly tried and very probably even a correct result in terms of liability the way it was tried. The unfortunate thing is this case had incredible ripple effect throughout the whole ski industry and throughout ski areas and the rest of the country in two ways. First of all, insurance companies all of a sudden started waking up to the types of risks that they were insuring and covering and started backing off. Also started increasing their premiums horrendously, and a lot of lawsuits started popping up against ski areas. One of the issues in the Sundy versus Stratton Corporation case was whether or not the skier assumed certain risks inherent in the sport of skiing. And there was a great deal of discussion and sorry to say, I think very legalistic discussion and not very enlightening discussion in the case about whether or not the doctrine of the substantive risk applies or not. However, the interpretations generally have been that the case, at least in part, held that the substantive risk does not apply. Oregon, ever since it went to comparative negligence, has, at least, first of all, statutorily said that assumption of the risk no longer applies in Oregon. But now there's some question on the basis of a couple of recent Supreme Court decisions in Oregon, perhaps in certain pursuits, assumption of the risk still does apply. But the question, quite frankly, is up in the air as it relates to ski area operations. Because of the, what I term the ripple effect, Petrie can talk, I mean, more directly to what the practical impact of the Sundy versus Stratton case has been in ski areas. Because of the ripple effect of that opinion countrywide, you are seeing, and we have seen, most of the states that have skiing facilities looking to their legislatures to enact some type of legislation to define the rights and responsibilities of the ski area operators and the skiers. The bill, Senate Bill 329, in its original form, was an exact carbon copy of the Washington statute that was passed last year in the state of Washington. On closer examination in the Senate, it appeared that that Washington law had an incredible number of faults. In fact, we even wondered how the thing got passed. And we felt that it could be improved upon. The bill was in the Senate Agriculture Committee, and Senator Hanlon appointed a subcommittee of myself, Senator Kulongoski, who all of you know is primarily a plaintiff attorney, and then also asked that Daryl Johnson, an attorney from Portland, who represents the ski area operators and has defended some ski area lawsuits, along with a representative of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and Mr. Petrie, sit down and rewrite the bill, rework the bill. What you have before you is the result of about six meetings among those of us that I just mentioned to work the bill and try to get it into presentable and acceptable shape to all parties, all of the parties that were involved. I would start out by saying that the trial lawyers took the position initially, and I think in fairness to them, they still feel this basically. They did not feel that there was a need for the bill. However, both Senator Kulongoski and I felt that the circumstances presented for the Senate Agriculture Committee by, mind you, a full room, which I have spared you here, but a full room of people, including skiers, representatives of ski clubs, ski patrols, ski instructors, as well as the owners and operators of ski areas, all testified as to a need for the bill. And so once we accepted the fact and made the decision that there was a need for the bill, the trial lawyers sat down with all of the rest of us, presented amendments, most of which were accepted, and in fact worked up this this compromise that is before you today. And what the bill basically does is this. In the relating introductory clause, it simply states, as a matter of policy, as a matter of legislative policy, the purpose of the act is to clarify the policy of the state governing the duties of skiers and the liabilities of operators of ski areas, and to affirm the principle that certain risks are inherent in the sport, and that as a matter of public policy, a person engaged in the sport should not recover damages for an operator for injuries resulting from those inherent risks. Section 1 of the Act is the definitional section. It also provides and defines further what those inherent risks or what some of those inherent risks of skiing are. Section 2 of the Act is intended to cover this situation.
Yeah, we're going to take questions now, Kip, or do you want
to? Yeah, I'll be happy to take questions as I go through it.
Okay. On the rocks and stumps, which are described as inherent risks of skiing, by identifying that as being a risk of skiing, does that mean that the ski area operator therefore has no obligation to put a couple of cross bamboo poles in front of it or flag it with the tape or whatever?
No, it does not. In the strict legal sense, I think in our contemplation of the operation of a ski area, as you well know, being a ski area yourself, that you will ski down a slope during the day, and as you start edging down the slope and scrape snow away, and rocks will bear out just due to the scraping. Things like that happen and are to be anticipated. On the other hand, if you have a boulder over a rise or over a particularly large mogul or a stump over a particularly large mogul, I think there is no question in the minds of members of the committee that there is an obligation and a duty on the part of the ski area operator to mark those kinds of obstructions.
So that you're saying that irrespective of the statement in Section 1, Sub 1, with respect to the fact that this is an inherent risk, that there still are occasions in which those items should be marked, and that the failure to mark them would not preclude cause of action.
Do you agree with that, Keith?
I would think so. Let me take a little. To flag or not to flag has been one of the most controversial questions in the ski business since I can remember. And as an example, you take a very early part of the season when it is obviously quite rocky and everything else, you'll have a certain number of season pass holders who will come up and say, I want to ski, operate that lift. I bought my season's pass, you're obligated to. Those cases, you cannot mark every one of them from any practical standpoint. In those areas where we have what we call the surprises, then I certainly say, yes, we should mark, and I don't know an operator that does not mark in there. And then we'll have that situation when, during the course of a day, something will bear out. But I would say that all the areas have pro patrol, paid patrols now, and these are marked. They're more effectively done on some types of runs than others. So.
Let me say this too, Representative Frommeyer. Looking at the operative section, Section 2, you will see that is where the phrase inherent risks of skiing is then put into operation with regards to the assumption of the risk. And that's what I was going to get to. As that reads in accordance with ORS 18.470, which is the comparative negligence statute, and notwithstanding subsection 2 of ORS 18.475, which currently repeals the assumption of the risk, doctrine of assumption of risk. They go on to say that the individual who engages in the sport of skiing accepts and assumes the inherent risks insofar as they are reasonably obvious, expected, or necessary. Those operative terms, it seems to me, address the situation you're speaking about, where you may have a boulder or a tree stump that is in plain view, so that it is in fact obvious. Then I think you would not have an obligation to mark, and you would have a situation there where the skier assumes a risk of being able to negotiate around that stump. On the other hand, if you have the blind situation that I alluded to, where you're going over a mogul or something like that, where you have that kind of obstruction, then I think that you can raise the question of whether or not it is reasonably obvious, expected, or necessary.
Okay, on the collisions with other skiers, some of the times when I've really had a bad spill, I've been clipped from behind by a drunk on skis. If there's a situation where the ski patrol is negligent by virtue of not getting those folks off the mountain when they've had too much from the boda bag, is that an inherent risk that I assume, or is there potentially at least a cause of action for the failure to supervise adequately the condition and nature and hot dogging of the skiers?
I would say that we all make a reasonable effort, but there are a lot of times when, and I think it's experience in driving too, that a person can be completely snockered and get on that chairlift, you know, and in the cold air and everything. There is no way that that operator can really tell. But yes, in those cases when somebody is obviously under the influence and we don't take them off the hill, and we had a situation at the ski bowl last year, exactly the same thing. In fact, we had to bring the state troopers down to finalize it. It was just one of those bad situations, but when you watch that person ski, initially you couldn't tell that he was under the influence. It wasn't until he did clobber and then had some problems with his bindings. But I would agree, yes, if we know he is under the influence, we should not load him. And if he is under the influence, we should escort him off the hill.
Okay, and that would not be, for these purposes, an inherent risk of skiing?
I do not believe so.
No.
Okay.
In fact, the whole gist of Section 2, and the reason that the phrase "in accordance with RS 18470 is in there, is that it was the conclusion, both of ourselves and of the Oregon trial lawyers, that clearly allowed for the situation where you may have injury caused by a combination of the assumption of the inherent risk by the skier and a combination of operator area negligence. In those cases where you have operator negligence, then it is thrown, and it is our understanding and our interpretation of this, and I think we've laid it pretty well out, at least on the Senate record of this, that at that point you bring in the doctrine of comparative negligence. So the assumption of the risk thing spells out what those risks are, and if the injury is due solely to one of those assumed risks, then it's intended to be a bar to the to recovery. But on the other hand, if operator negligence is alleged, then you get into the comparative negligence issue. It's a jury question of whether both causation and whether or not you have comparative negligence. Okay, that is also, as I say, my way of also explaining Section 2, which is the operative provision of the bill. Section 3,
Rips of Coleman. Yeah, I'd like to go back, if you don't mind, for a clarifying point on the question of the rock outcropping, which is, yeah, is really, how do we know, or how do we argue whether it was something that I should have known about as a skier and been aware of, or whether, in fact, it's something that should have been, I mean, I guess I have, the only problem I have is somehow who's going to make the decision. Does the court go? Who makes the guidelines on who's where that responsibility begins and ends?
Again, I think that even trial lawyers here would tell you this: in a lot of these cases where you may either statutorily legislate a duty or even have a common law duty enunciated in by way of court decision, the ultimate determination is going to be a jury question. And you may very well, in this situation, when you want to talk about, again, I return you to the operative language of open, obvious, expected, and necessary. That in itself will probably be the jury question as to whether or not it was. If the jury determines that it was, then the doctrine applies in your bar. The jury says, on the other hand, that it wasn't reasonably obvious, expected, or necessary, then the doctor does not apply. Okay.
I have another good example.
Keith,
of that one.
You get it.
Can I have one more time?
Representative Cohen.
Okay. does this then, we're going to end up with more or less court cases because of failing to agree on that particular three words independently?
That I could never predict. I think hopefully, it certainly was our feeling and hope that by spelling out both the risks, or at least as far as we could spelling out the risks, by also spelling out the duties and obligations of the skiers, that there would be a better understanding of skiers on the slopes as to what their rights and obligations were, and hopefully forestall some spurious litigation, but still leave the avenue open for the people who had a valid claim.
I have one more question. How much difference are we making from what the existing policy is now by insertion of these?
Let me say this. Probably the greatest difference I feel is this. So we are codifying concepts, rules, regulations, and things presently not codified, on which there is a great deal of questions whether or not they would apply to, say, the assumption of the risk doctrine. There is a great deal of question whether or not Oregon courts would recognize that as still applicable in the light of our very negligent statute. Secondly, the so-called rules of the road or rules of the slope and skiers under Section 4 are not presently codified, and this would simply lay out in the statutes what those rules are. It would be will be not only the requirement of the bill, but the intention of the CRA operators to post those rules, and there's to have the imprimatur of Oregon state law under them, and hopefully would have a regulating effect on the conduct of the skiers. Mr. Petrie did have a comment, I believe, in regards to the hit rock.
Mr. Petrie. One of the most obvious one of you call what is obvious would be the new Palmer chairlift at Timberline, where when you get on, you look up there and you can see rock croppings all over. And there's a situation where a rock certainly can appear during the course of the day. I think skiing that lift, you just better plan on it. You take the Moldapore ski area, which is basically an area that is very well known for. We do have basically almost grass slopes to the point of a golf course. I won't quite say that good, but people do not expect rocks on or stumps on the Moldapore slopes. Those should be marked in there. The only other thing I would add, if I might, is that one of the things I feel that the bill does is it clarifies those areas of responsibility of the individual skier over which the operator has no control. Like this hot dogging down the run for the first time, or skiing across a T-bar line, or something like that. We can make every effort, but this, in a sense, puts it in a perspective and gives us something to lean back on for education. And I think a very prominent and beneficial part of this legislation will be the educational aspect of it in the long run.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Mason.
Well, before I start thinking on the bill, I would like to say that I think there's a necessity to codify in the statute the assumption of risk doctrine. I think that's very reasonable, and I endorse that concept fully. I don't have any problem with that. However, I've got some other problems with the bill, and I just want you to know that I think assumption of risk makes eminent sense in a skiing situation, and I would like to see that in the statute. The rest of it, I got some disagreement with, but assumption of risk, I think, and your inherent risk of skiing, I think that's a good definition, although I think it should be clear that you do mention lift towers and structures and their components. I don't think an inherent risk to a skiing would be a lift tower or a component collapsing while you're
nope.
in the I would like that to be shown that you don't want to, that's not, it's an inherent risk running into it when you're skiing, but
that's
it's not
right.
inherent risk.
But it's not, a defect in the tower itself or in the lift mechanism itself is not something that generally reasonably obvious, expected, or necessary,
yeah.
And I think that it was very clearly, again, laid on the record in the Senate hearings that defects in equipment are not intended to be insulated by this bill, by any means at all.
But you can't expect that your eyes open, you may run into a tower.
That's true, yes. And that really is the expectation that that is anticipated by the bill.
Yeah. Just a minor point, but on page 2 of the bill, in line 36, you say skiers must wear retention straps or other devices to prevent runaway skis.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you have a ski break, you don't wear that, technically, do you? Or are you?
No, you're right, and I think that there's probably a reasonableness there, and I grant it.
Unless you mean by wearing your skis, you're wearing the device.
I think that's what was thought of at the time. You're wearing the ski, you're wearing this, and that is attached to the ski.
Yeah,
that's the very reason we were looking at that wording, because they do have good ski brakes now.
Now, Section 3 of the bill does present a new concept to this type of civil tort liability. As you know, in the municipal tort liability field today, you have a notification requirement that requires that you give notice to the municipality, the municipal government, of your intent to file a claim. In fact, a notice of your claim, you have to file a claim and enumerate in the claim your damages and so forth. This bill in Section 3 provides for notice to be given within 180 days after injury or discovery of injury. Notice of injury. Now, this differs significantly from notice of claim under municipal tort liability law. Again, under municipal tort liability law, you have to be very specific in what you put in your notice of claim. Under this bill, it is simply notification of the occurrence of the injury. The ARRI operator testified in support of this provision for the reason that because of the nomadic nature of their employees, most of them are there for one season and then gone, and to enable them to adequately investigate their accidents and injuries, take testimony of employees and what have you, they felt that this was a very critical portion of the bill. So we provide for 180-day notice of injury.
Representative Long, Rusford, excuse me.
Bill.
How would that assist them?
How would it assist them?
Right.
It would put them on notice that an injury had occurred, if they weren't already on notice. At that point, then I think they would crank in their adjusters, or their own insurance adjusters, or if they did their own investigations, they could at least start contacting their employees to investigate the consequences and get the employees' stories as to the consequences of the injuries and so forth, and circumstances, conditions of the slope, you know, what, to the best of your recollection, were the conditions of the slope on that day? Was it icy? Were there markers? Were markers removed? What were the weather conditions? What were the ski patrol situation? How many people on patrol? How many skiers? Just any kinds of factors that would be important to be able to investigate and know about in the investigation of a ski injury. Now, we recognize in this section, and from the practical standpoint of it, probably in 90 to 99% of the cases, there will already be notice of injury, because the ski patrol will have been involved, and they do keep a log of injuries, and they testified as such. In conjunction in discussions with the trial lawyers, they felt that this provision would be acceptable in the bill if we provided significant outs for people who had not otherwise given notice. And so we provide, beginning there on line 15, for the excuse from failure to give notice, excuse due basically to three circumstances. The first one, of course, is if the early operator already has knowledge of the injury, and so that negates the necessity of giving notice. Secondly, if the skier or the skier's beneficiaries could show good cause for failure to give notice. And thirdly, if the ski area operator fails to comply with subsection 5 of that section, and again, to strengthen this section and put people on notice, we have put a requirement in the bill that a notice be posted in a conspicuous place to inform skiers that if they are injured, they must notify the area of the injury.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
If the patrol notes the injury on its log, if the ski patrol notes the injury on its log, is that considered notice to the ski area operator? Like, would that be constructive notice for the purposes of this exception
yes.
of the 180 day thing?
Yes. Yes. And in fact, we get a kind of a double whammy on this notice provision because you see under, in that paragraph of the bill, we specifically require the posting of the notice. And then you get down under section 4, which I have described broadly as the rules of the slope. And you'll note over at the top of page 3, one of the rules of the slope is likewise that a skier who is injured should, if possible, give notice of the injury to the ski area operator. And those rules must likewise be posted. Section 5, finally, is the requirement of posting of the rules of the slope under Section 4. Now, one of the questions that was raised in subcommittee was, why don't you have in this bill the duties and obligations of the ski area operator? In the original bill, we did have those duties and obligations listed. However, it was felt that, first of all, there were some questions about working through those obligations and the propriety of having them in the bill, but I think the overriding consideration was that all ski area operators, except I think he said one in the state of Oregon.
Apparently I was wrong. Every ski area operator,
all right,
everybody comes under that. There's no way they can get insurance without coming under
all right.
that.
Every ski area operator is required to comport with safety requirements under the American National Standards Institute. These are promulgated here. They are required in every federal permit. I think all but one area in the state of Oregon are under a federal permit with the Department of Agriculture, U.S. Forest Service. And so they are already required under federal law to comport with a number of rules and regulations in terms of what their duties and obligations are on regarding maintenance of the slope and equipment, marking and things like that. That's the gist of the bill.
Questions? Representative
Romar. Kip, do you have any evidence that insurance will be easier to obtain or that at least the insurance situation will be stabilized if this bill passed?
Okay, the, what was the gentleman's name? Yeah.
Graham Anderson. And who negotiates directly for what we call a Western plan directly with Lloyd's of London, and the answer is yes, it will have a stabilizing effect.
That was the testimony before the Senate committee, and I was there at the time, and I talked with Mr. Anderson after the Senate hearing, and he writes the does the underwriting for most, if not all, of Northwest ski area operators.
Almost all the Western.
All the Western.
Western. There are only two insurance companies that will write in insurance in the United States now, one of which is Lloyd's of London, the other is the American. And that's what we're down to. Had the law not been in a similar type of legislation in Vermont, they would not have written insurance in Vermont. Both companies just said no way.
I might say, following the Stratton decision in Vermont, the Vermont legislature reinstated statutorily the doctrine of assumption of risk in Vermont.
Representative Rutherford?
Is there any reason why you didn't go the assumption of risk route in connection with this bill?
We did. That was Senator Gulongoski's original intent, and it was a feeling that under both the definition provision of Section 1 and the operative provision of Section 2 that we had, in fact, reinstated the doctrine of assumption of risk.
Why did you not simply reinstate the doctrine of assumption of risk rather than going through the short statute of limitations and establishing the other rules of the road?
I think it was felt that it would be legislatively helpful, and given the input that we had in the committee from the area experts, to go further and delineate what some of those risks would include. I mean, going back to the definitional section, you'll see that it provides that they include but are not limited to. It still leaves some room for argument, but it was felt that by delineating this, delineating some of the risks that are inherently, that are assumed, that again we would be serving a public notice function in part to educate the public as to what they anticipate, what they reasonably anticipate, what they are responsible for when they get on the slopes.
Well, the difficulty, it seems to me, that arises at that point is, let's take the case of the bare spots and the stumps and so on. I think the witness testified that this is more effectively done on some slopes than on others. And I guess then the question would be, well, what is the standard that's going to be used in connection with when these are going to be marked and when they're not? And isn't it the ski operator that's going to be deciding this standard, who is the person who has a bias and an interest in the outcome? And if he decides that it's to be marked or not to be marked, then that apparently is the determining factor.
Well, in answer to your question, yes, the ski operator will decide where to mark and where not to mark. And yes, he will be doing so at his peril. But I think what with the operative language of reasonably obvious, expected, or necessary, that at least that gives him a risk management standard by which he can hopefully attempt to decide whether or not to mark in a given situation. And risk management, as you know, is one of the things in the minds of insurance companies, that where they feel that a risk can be effectively managed, then they're much more willing to underwrite the loss or the potential of loss. Where they don't feel that the risk can be managed or that the risk is even well defined, then they're a lot more edgy to get about getting into to underwriting the risk. So it's a manageable standard. It is a subjective standard, without doubt. I can tell you as a skier, I'm sure Representative Frommeyer can tell you as a skier, there are times when you'll go down the slope early in the season when you know it's rocky, when you know stumps are out there, and you know you have to ski accordingly. And it's going to be reasonably obvious and expected as you go down the slope. On the other hand, there are times when there is and should be plenty of snow, and for some reason or another, you still have a large stump or tree or rock or the like that is hidden from view. And at that point, I think the wise improvement operator can say that's not reasonably obvious, that's not reasonably expected or necessary, and it was marked.
Well, if it's to be a negligence standard, why didn't we use the negligence as the standard here? For instance, what is reasonable under the circumstances then and there existing, rather than reasonably obvious, expected, or necessary, which is a standard that I haven't seen any other place in the law.
No, Bill, I think if you'll recall, I believe I'm correct from law school days when we did have assumption of the risk, that part of the definition of assumption of the risk is that you assume those risks that only that were reasonably obvious, necessary, and expected.
But what you told me is that those are the risks assumed by the skier.
That's right.
Now, when I ask you with respect to the marking of the trails, you tell me that the ski operator has the same standard, that he is operating under the assumption of the risk.
Well,
skier can operate under the assumption of the risk.
We're talking about a negative because the corollary of the doctrine of the assumption of the risk is that the operator of the amusement, or whatever it is, has a duty under the common law, even where you have assumption of the risk, to protect the participant or the assumer of the risk from those from those risks that were not reasonably obvious, expected, or necessary. If you look, it seems to me, my recollection of the baseball cases and things like that, is that you could pretty well define what risks were reasonably obvious and necessary. reasonably obvious, expected, and necessary on the one hand, but that there were also alleged in those cases, by way of example, risks that weren't, that didn't come under that standard, and consequently that threw liability back on the operator or the purveyor of the unit. What I'm saying is that the operator of the ski area has to make a decision to protect the skiers against those risks which are not reasonably obvious, expected, or necessary. I think under the common law, that's what he's liable for.
Person, run through, read through? Or?
Gordon?
Yeah. Person Mason.
Well, when I asked Mr. Johnson about Section 4 and whether or not defense in a case involving liability here, involving a ski operator, could ask for a jury instruction on, based on what you have in Section 4, he answered in the affirmative, and I think he was right. However, that's what bothers me particularly, is that while the defendant in this case may be able to ask for a jury instruction, which will start with the phrase, Oregon law requires that, as most jury instructions do, the plaintiff in such a case, I don't think, regardless of that green book there, will have quite the authority to rely on for the requested jury instruction, although that may have the status of regulation. It'll have the status of federal regulation.
Well,
I can see that you can bootstrap your instruction in saying federal regulation requires such. I, for one, would be much more comfortable if there was specific reference in Section 4 to duties of the ski area operator so that there would be a kind of parity on the part of the plaintiff. The plaintiff could say, Oregon law requires that ski operators do such and such. And if there was a companion section in this bill that said, ski area operators shall maintain their areas in accordance with this regulation here, that would be fine, but there's no parity here.
All right, Representative Mason, Mr. Petrie has just refreshed my memory as to another thing that I recall now was brought up in the hearings on this. Under ORS 460.310 and subsequent provisions governing amusement rides, devices and equipment generally associated with winter sports activities such as ski lifts, ski tows, J-bars, T-bars, ski mobiles, chairlifts, and aerial tramways are covered under the amusement rides provisions of the code. And the Department of Commerce is given the authority to adopt rules. And in doing so, the department shall be guided by the safety standards approved by the American Standards Association, which is this association. It's not a direct statement in the code of what the obligations of the ski area operator are. However, I believe that in any given case that you could frame, and I believe you'd have the license to frame your jury instructions in terms of the operator is operating under a permit, which permit requires that he comply with the American National Standards provisions, and he did or did not comply. If you find that he did comply in this instance, I think you'd go on with your instruction, or if you find that he did not comply. He is required, however. Now, the second thing is this. I think you will find under Section 4 that most of those rules of the slope probably would not be brought into play in an action between a skier and the operator itself. In my perusal of those instructions, those would more often than not come into play in an action by a skier against another skier, or negligence caused by the other skier, because you'll see that those are, by and large, those are rules of movement. Not all of them, but by and large, they are rules of movement covering movement in the sport, just like automobile, boating, and what have you.
Well, except for I, which has directly to do with rope tows and devices.
Right.
And your point on 46310 probably is well taken, except that only has to do with your lift devices. But what about the actual condition of the slope? There's no statutory connection. I didn't see any statutory connection with the condition of the slope in your
46310. No, it does not. This does not apply to that. That's right. I can tell you the typical example where I think it would come into play in a jury instruction, and that would have to do with the marking of the difficulty of the slope. And if there were a trail in a ski area that was obviously a ski trail but it was improperly marked, or if it was closed but not marked closed, or if the degree of difficulty was improperly marked and you had a skier attempting to go down that slope who was not capable of handling it, then I can see in that type of a situation that you would want a jury instruction to the effect that the operator was required to mark slope a degree of difficulty and did not do so. Now that is not in the rules here, of course, but I believe, correct me, am I wrong, Keith, do the rules provide for your individual marking?
All the areas mark under a similar standard, which is worldwide, called the Federation of International Skiing, and that system is used throughout, and we finally got all the countries together to go on it, and we all mark in that manner.
Well, does that have the force of law, however?
Are those included in your standards or not?
No, the degree of difficulty of slopes is not. But this is one of the hardest things to determine, and why it has been this way is because what is difficult to one skier is not difficult to another, and that changes on given days. And also, some people like groom slope and some people don't like groom slope. In there, but here again, I think you certainly are going to pack from common sense basis your beginner slopes, your intermediate slopes, your slopes that are good and steep and not lots of good powder. The public won't tolerate them being packed or groomed.
But
so it's the law does not, and how you would write that, I think, has been kicked around for many years, and nobody has come up with a solution.
4D says skiers shall familiarize themselves with posted information on location and degree of difficulty of trails and slopes to the extent possible for skiing on a slope or trail. Therefore, the defendant could ask for a jury instruction on you didn't inform yourself as to the degree and difficulty.
If we don't have a map up there showing the degree, I bet you we should be nailed.
I think the comment of that is that if they don't post it, skier says you didn't post it, you didn't have it anywhere, then I think the skier would be entitled to a jury instruction.
Well,
that
there's
effect.
Nothing in here that says that they have to post, though.
Yeah, but Ripson Mason's to their advantage to post it. I mean, if they don't post it, then the skier basically has the advantage, whereas if they post it, and it's in a conspicuous place, then they have the advantage. So they've got every reason in the world to post it, and if they don't post it, they get nailed.
Well, the whole point was they get nailed, but not nailed under statute. They get nailed under traditional negligence, where on the other side we have the skier tied down by statute on the fact that the skier has to familiarize himself with the degree of difficulty, where the ski operator does not have to put up the posting, does not have to post. Because of statute, that's just good common sense. There's no parity there.
Well,
I think you would end up with parity, though, in the courtroom if you didn't have the posting. If it wasn't posted, I can't imagine.
Would you object to a provision saying that slopes shall be posted in accordance with what you just told us? What was the name of the? Of the way they're the international
American
standards.
National Standards Institute.
I think our problem is in the
FIS standards. Yeah, I think our problem at this point, Tom, in writing in any detail area operator standards, is that we really did not consider those at any great length once we showed and discussed with the the subcommittee over in the Senate what the requirements and obligations were from these volumes, and this is just the general posting requirement. And we really didn't get into writing, you know, what of those obligations we should include, which ones we shouldn't include, how much detail we should get into, and so forth. I would be hesitant at this point to start enumerating some of the obligations and leave out others. It might be at a future point that an attempt to enumerate area operator obligations would be worthwhile. I hesitate to do so without having the people whom I really consider the experts here to do so. And I think, you know, Darrell Johnson is one of those individuals who has worked in this context with a number of CRA operator cases, and I just would not feel comfortable making that attempt to start now to do it, although I certainly there was no feeling, I can't say that there was any animosity or antagonism in the subcommittee against enumerating those obligations. It was just a feeling that we were satisfied that they were there.
Well, I guess my objection remains, you have enumerated obligations.
That's right.
To the skiers, but you have not enumerated obligations to the operators. And I guess that's the foundation of my objection, is that you did an awfully good job of enumerating the obligations to the skiers, but kind of passed over obligations of the operators.
Yeah. Again, I don't think we passed them over, but the fact of the matter was that those obligations were written elsewhere. The fact is that the obligations of the skier are not written elsewhere, are not even given the imprimatur of a rule. And that's why we put these in the bill.
Representative Rutherford?
The other thought I had in this area that Representative Mason was talking about, you indicated at one time during subcommittee that you wish to establish these as sort of rules of the road for the skiers, but they are apparently in the bill for the purpose of establishing the skiers' conduct vis-a-vis the ski operator. And that seemed to me, first of all, I have the same reservation Representative Mason had, but secondly, it struck me peculiar that we would have a list of obligations of a skier with respect to another skier, and then say that standard is also applied to the ski operator.
I don't understand.
Well, I think the example given in the subcommittee was if a skier didn't tie their bindings on their ski, and that ski went loose and caused injury to another skier, that would exculpate the ski operator from any responsibility. And that very well be so, but I wonder why you put in the responsibility between skiers, we put that in this list, which is really a list of responsibilities of the skier to the ski operators.
Okay.
Whether or not if somebody ties their bindings, doesn't seem to
obligate
the ski operator at all.
Maybe I have portrayed this bill as simply being a skier operator's bill. And if so, I'd have to, you know, back off and say that really is not entirely the case. A major portion of the bill and a major intent of the bill is to define the skier's relationship with other skiers, vis-a-vis other skiers, without relationship to the operator. And that binding case, the strap case, is just such an example. Because what usually happens in that case is that if a skier does ski without a binding, loses a ski, if anybody's hurt, or if anything's hurt, it's another skier. And that would clearly create a case of liability among, you know, or between skiers. If a car, you know, if the brakes fail on a car, and we have a statute that says you'll keep your equipment in operating order, including operating brakes, it basically creates liability or establishes a liability case between operators of vehicles or an operator and an owner of adjacent property. You don't bring the highway commission in that owns the highway in that kind of a case.
And I could add this point too, from a practical standpoint, you know, when you get on the legal end, you know, I'm out of it. But from the practical standpoint here, again, we are working under the regulations of the Forest Service, and we developed a safety plan of which the signing and degree of difficulty signing is part of that, and I would certainly think that if we failed to follow our safety plan, as we agreed to with the Forest Service and our and the Forest Service enforces, then I think we'd be negligent.
Well, except I would agree with you, but the bill doesn't place that duty on the ski operators. It merely lists all the things that the skiers have to do.
That's right.
We are not opposed to any of that whatsoever, but here is, you know, as the discussions went on in the Senate, you know, through those six or seven sessions, it was decided that this was adequately covered, and so I wouldn't know more to say than that. Are we back to point A then?
As I say, Bill, it probably could be developed. We just, early in the subcommittee session over there, abandoned the thought of developing statutorily an extensive list of operator statutory responsibilities, because I think we were all satisfied that those responsibilities were thoroughly covered in the permit system and in the regulations. So I don't think they're not without obligations.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Representative Rutherford.
The other difficulty I've had, Bill, as I expressed in the subcommittee, was that with respect to the short statute of limitations. And I just simply have to say I think we have a policy difference at that point. I understand why you wish to have it in, but it seems to me that if we have a 180-day statute of limitations, in this case, I can't understand why we would distinguish ski operators from manufacturers or
carnivals.
Yeah, any number of other activities, which will soon, it seems to me, to import 180-day statute of limitations.
I don't disagree that this is a major policy decision that we have felt has some validity in this case. And in fact, I would suggest that if you look at a number of the proposals being presented around the country today and even existing in legislation, I've gone through a number of statutes, both in this area and in the tavern owner's liability area in other states, and a lot of states are putting in notification of injury provisions. Now, they are not as detailed as Oregon's notice of claim requirement for municipal tort liability, but for notification of injury. And, plainly, among other things, it is just simply intended to put people on notice that an accident or injury has occurred on their premises. And I guess I would argue I don't think that's a bad policy at all. I think what we have seen not a lot of, but what we certainly have seen some of, in our public policy is that we've seen people who come back 2 years later and claim that an injury occurred on premises or due to somebody's a condition in somebody's premises, and nobody was ever notified of it at the time, and it's a big guessing game, but it'll still go to the jury as to what happened.
Especially even under this bill, they could come back 180 days later.
That's
and
true.
The same.
That's true. No question about that. That was the acceptable limit agreed upon by ourselves and the trial lawyers.
Representative Mason.
Well, even in the 2 year situation, you come back with a story and try to convince the jury that after 2 years you suddenly showed up and decided you'd been injured. That's going to wear real thin in front of a jury pretty quick. And I don't think you're going to have much of a case. You're going to have to convince the jury that you were seriously injured and you didn't tell anyone and it just happened and you only have to be the only witness, maybe your wife or your woman, your husband. That isn't going to be a little shaky.
Now, let me say this again. If you're talking about major injuries, serious injuries in 99 and 44, 100% of the cases, the area will already have that notification. It's just the nature of the sport and policing of the area and what have you. This is intended to get, quite honestly, at those fringe cases, at those fringe areas where somebody comes up with an injury at some point later in time, a strained back or a bum knee or something, and says, oh, I must have done it at the ski area, and has some friends who will pony up a story or come up with a story as to what happened. The operator has no witnesses left, has not had an opportunity to investigate the incident contemporaneously with the incident.
Has that been happening?
It's happened to me.
Yes.
What happened to you?
Possible can.
You say someone phonied up a claim?
I won't say. I can't say it was phonied up, but it came back 2.5 years later. Was the first knowledge we had of the claim, and boy, we could not, you know, get the people.
This was in Washington?
Yes, it
they
was.
They had a longer statute of limitations?
I think it's 3 years up there. But it was right in that neighborhood. I had come in as the new manager, and, well, I'll tell you, it was kind of a...
What was the disposition of the claim?
The plaintiff won.
The plaintiff won the game?
Uh-huh.
What was the award?
I think it was around 40,000, 50,000 or something in that neighborhood. In the interim, I didn't follow the case that directly through because of another insurance carrier. But I know the incident happened. I know trying to put it together was just a real chore.
Representative Cohen, were you through?
Well, I was just going to ask if the case was tried to a jury.
Yes, it was a jury trial.
Representative Cohen.
I just want to address a question to other committee members here. I'm interested in if you have amendments.
The chairman has left the room momentarily, but it would be my caution to the committee that we do have another bill of some major importance to take up before a 3:30 session. And at this point, we've had a lot of discussion, but no suggested amendments, and we ought to be moving toward some resolution of either the problems with the bill or moving on the bill.
I'd say this, Norm, as a member of the committee and also as one of those who worked on what I felt was a fragile coalition between the defense attorneys and the trial lawyers. Everybody reached agreement on it. Everybody was happy about it. Probably ought to let Mr. Martini speak to that. And everybody was satisfied, you know, that we reached an acceptable compromise, that we had a good bill, and nobody really wanted to monkey with it from there on.
Representative Lombard?
Yes.
Representative Smith has just moved the House, the Senate Bill 329, Ann Gross, be sent to the floor if the due pass recommendation. Before I place that motion, I have one question. I guess that's in the nature of legislative intent. And it is, was it, or is it your intent that the negligence, if there was negligence on the part of the skier, that that be compared on a comparative basis?
Yes.
Okay.
If there is negligence on the part of the operator and negligence on the part of the skier, it was my understanding that it was clearly the intent of the committee, and as expressed in Section 2 of the bill, then it would go into a comparative negligence situation. That would trigger the comparative negligence.
Is there any exception to that legislative intent? If not, that will be adopted if the bill does move out. The motion is by Representative Smith to send Senate Bill 329, Aiden Gross, the fourth due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rutherford.
I think perhaps by way of voting information before we vote, I won't be able to support the bill, and the reasons are the following. Number one, in the subcommittee, and I don't know if it came out in testimony before this committee, it appeared that there had been very few cases arising against ski operators in Oregon. This was the testimony of Mr. Johnson, the attorney, who indicated that he represented the ski operators. I think the testimony was that in nearly all of those cases, the ski operators won, except perhaps in one or two. And again, my recollection was, is subject to someone else's recollection, that they had not paid out any significant sums in terms of damages. So it doesn't appear to me that there is that the case is a problem within the state of Oregon. Secondly, I think that the act has been drawn in such a manner as to place the burden primarily upon the skier, and that the ski operator does not carry a commensurate burden I think that Section 3 of the bill, which purports to limit the statute of limitations in some cases to 180 days, is not a policy which we should accept, and I predict that if we accept it here, we will see it in a vast number of cases. If not this section, then certainly next, and it will only serve to limit those persons who have been injured from recovery. Finally, Section 4, which apparently is purported to be a section which limits the, or sets forth the standards that the skiers have with respect to the operators, does much more than that, and I'm not clear why it does that, but if it does, it seems to me it should have been changed. Fifth, there is no statement in here with respect to the ski operator's liability vis-a-vis the skier. It seems to me it's only reasonable for us to set the standards for one and we set the standards for the other.
Representative, wish to amend Representative Smith's motion.
State your motion.
I'll amend Representative Smith's motion to delete Sections 3, 4, and 5 of the bill.
Representative Mason moves that Sections 3, 4, and 5 of the bill be deleted. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I'll be very candid. I think your concept is very good, and I have a ski area operator as a constituent, Mr. Reynolds. I think it's a good concept. I'm not uncomfortable at all with putting assumption of risk back into the law. I think that makes sense. I do think, very frankly, that all the king's horses and all the king's men can convince me that this is overreaching in Sections 3, 4, and 5. 5 is incidental, let's say, as opposed to Section 4 is tenuous at best. Section 3 is the basis for that for Section 3 is just conjecture. As Representative Rutherford said, it's nice that you're going to have everybody else back in here wanting a 180-day statute of limitation. Anybody who can give us any reason at all. And now the reason for the 180-day statute of limitations is that their employees tend to move a little bit. They tend to be transient. Well, how many other industries have transient employees? I think we sat here long enough, we come up with quite a few industries. The word's going to get out. And everybody who has an employee that is transient, I would say the first people in are probably taxi cabs. The taxi cab operators tend to turn over a lot, that type of thing. And you can go on from there to carnivals and commercial fishing boats.
Take your walk, Representative Bugis.
The point being that the basis of this bill is good. And I've known, but you're asking for just too much, and I really feel very bad about that because I think you're gonna make some good law and you're gonna just pull in a lot of bad law in its wake. And I wish that the proponents of this bill had just backed off a little bit, and it would have been satisfied with the reinstituting of this of assumption of risk doctrine. Instead, you've asked for just too much. You've asked for 180-day statute of limitation, that's just too much. I'm sorry. And your assumption of risk is fine. But if we give you 180-day statute of limitation, the doctors will be in here next time. And the week after that, the lawyers will be there for our own malpractice situations. So I would, in lieu of discussion of the motion to delete, to amend Representative Smith's motions to delete Sections 3, 4, and 5, which I believe, if I've read this right, would have the effect of merely preserving the guts of the bill, the assumption of risk portion, which I believe is commendable.
Further discussion, Representative Walker.
Try to be very brief. I think the practical effect of that would be to lose the whole bill in the Senate. The way it came over from the Senate, I just have reason to believe that practically it would jeopardize the bill. I don't doubt and I don't quarrel with the new policy in Section 3. I think it is overstating it that it is a, quote, statute of limitations. I've never heard us speak of a six-month statute of limitations on municipal tort claims. We still have a two-year statute of limitations in which to file the action. We have a notification provision, and that is what is the new concept. nothing unusual about stating the rules of the road under Section 4, and in fact, whether it be automobile traffic, boat traffic, or otherwise, I think it makes reasonable policy where you have large groups in movement that certain rules of the road or rules of the slope, however you want to call them, make sense. And that's why that is in the bill. I would say, as I said before, I think that it would be appropriate, perhaps, at a later time to sit down and look at codifying some of the obligations of ski area operators. I don't think anybody is opposed to that concept. Perhaps we just assume too much in the subcommittee and in the Senate, but in terms of whether or not those obligations were adequately provided at this time. But I, as I say, at a future point, I wouldn't have any objections to working with that. At this point, however, at this time of the session, I'm afraid that any significant changes in this bill will jeopardize it.
Further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll on the motion. The motion is Representative Mason is to delete Sections 3, 4, and 5.
Representative
Mason? Yes. Richard?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Smith?
No.
Dugan?
No.
Cohen?
No.
Barger?
No.
Fails. Motion now is by Representative Smith to move Senate Bill 329 as, well, it's not amended. Anchor Senate Bill 329 to the floor if it do pass recommendation. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Rutherford?
No.
Richard?
No.
Mason?
No.
Lombard?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Dugan?
Aye.
Gardner?
Aye. It passes.
Mr. Chairman, give notice of possible minority report.
I was surprised. Representative Mason serves notice of possible minority report on Senate Bill 329.
And by way of vote explanation, I still think it's a good concept.
Well,
I guess that
next bill on the agenda for work session is Senate Bill 893.
Chairman, I believe that Mr. Wilson has some proposed amendments which are designed to take care of the objections that were raised in the subcommittee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Otto Wilson, Director of Oregon Retail Council, a division of Associated Oregon Industries. And I come today to urge your support of Senate Bill 893, a significant anti-shoplifting measure. In Subcommittee 3 yesterday, the committee carefully reviewed the provisions of the bill and discovered committee counsel pointed out a discrepancy with the statutes, and there were several comments about wording not being favorable. You have now in hand amendments that we wish to propose that I believe will relieve the conflicts that were alluded to yesterday. Attached to the amendments is a hand-engrossed bill that I think will make it easier for you to understand our proposals. And if I may, I'll take just a moment to run through them very quickly. In line 16, rather in line... First one is line 15, excuse me. There was some question of whether the additional penalty as mentioned related to the previous provision of penalty to the owner, and with some concern that it might be confusing, we have responded to the suggestion and suggest that after the word penalty we insert to the owner, so it's very specific. Probably is not needed, but it isn't of any consequence and so it's best to meet that objection. In line 16, we come to the item that was called to our attention by committee counsel, that there is a conflict in the provision of the bill with the ORS 126080, which provides that a guardian is not legally obligated to provide from his own funds for the ward and is not liable to third persons by reason and so forth. And we have some quarrel actually with the statute, feeling that it has some implications that aren't appropriate, but we don't feel this is an appropriate time for us to bite off that chunk to chew. And therefore, we suggest that in the bill we simply strike the provision for legal guardian. Therefore, it will read the parents having custody of. On line 21, again, we insert to the owner for the additional penalty. And then we had a number of items in subsection 3 of section 2. That caused some concern in wording and implication. And meeting with our counsel and with members of the committee that is responsible in my organization for this bill, it was the recommendation that we simply strike all of subsection 3, which deals with changes in evidence. The changes in subsection numbering follow, having eliminated section 3. Then on line 8 of page 2, let's take line 6. In line 6 of page 2, again, following the change made on page 1 in regard to guardian, we would strike legal or legal guardian in line 6 and 7. Therefore, it would read, limits liability of parents of minor children. And then there was a question in line 8, and providing for a small claims court action, whether it could be misinterpreted to mean that that was an exclusive provision rather than a permissive provision. We think the language is strictly permissive, having said may rather than shall or must, but in order to meet that objection, we suggest that after the word in, it would read may be brought in any court, and committee counsel suggested that competent would be a more appropriate legal term than appropriate, and we're perfectly comfortable with that, and so it would read, and if you would change that on your copy, brought in any court of competent jurisdiction, including the small claims department and so forth. We feel that the amendments place the bill in excellent condition. It's acceptable to us, and I believe it will provide what the retail community and the people of the state of Oregon need in a more positive deterrent to shoplifting. And I urge your favorable consideration.
Okay, just to get this moving along and see if there is any support for the bill, the chair had moved the adoption of the amendments titled A and Gross Senate Bill 893 as provided to you in the Hand and Gross version, with the change in deletion of the word appropriate on page 2 and the insertion of the word competent. Is there discussion?
I think I gave Mr. Wilson probably a little bit too much of bedtime yesterday, but I find the amendments very attractive. I'm going to support the amendments and support the bill. I think they did a good job.
Thank you.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair. Well, I'm not. I have something to a question to ask, but it not necessarily pertains to the amendment, so I can wait.
Discussion? Objection? Hearing none, they're adopted. Chair would then move Senate Bill 893 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Okay, I want some clarification, please, on line 10, the subsection now 6, with respect to exactly how this works, since I was not a member of the subcommittee, didn't hear your explanation of how the owner brings action
and whether the person who's notified by that demand in writing is to perceive that. I mean, is it going to be clearly understood that they...
Does that have to go to court first, or is it just a personal private kind of action between somebody sending me a bill?
As Mr. Chairman and Representative Cohen, as it reads, that this that a demand in writing may be presented prior to the commencement of any legal action. However, the procedure and the chain of events is that upon apprehension and the decision that the apprehension is correct and that a valid case exists, then arrest is made.
Okay, let me stop right now. Who makes that decision?
Management of a store must make that decision, whether they are going to prosecute.
Or send a letter. I mean, I still don't have that clear, Mr. Chairman. I need some more support.
I'll start back again. There is on the books today, of course, the theft statute, theft 2, applying to shoplifting. This is not replacing that, but is in addition to the criminal statute. The procedure in the store would be, I am apprehended, having been observed taking goods. Now, the procedure in doing that is quite flexible, but the owner or management must always have in mind that if he does not follow appropriate steps that will stand up in court, that he's going to be in trouble. If he feels that he has a valid apprehension, the person actually has been observed, they left the premises, then he can detain that person according to the statute for a reasonable period of time in order to question, and he can call the police and file a charge. But the police are the ones who arrest. From that point on, the case is in the hands of the district attorney as far as criminal prosecution is concerned. The retailer will have this option of proceeding with a demand letter for the penalties due him under this statute and the privilege of prosecuting in a civil procedure.
Representative,
is that an exclusive option? In other words, you either go one way or you go the other?
No, sir, that's not true.
Okay, that's what I thought I read here. So that even if the parent, for example, should respond to the demand letter by paying the amount suggested, then there still would be criminal prosecution nonetheless, potentially.
Potentially.
Okay, very commonly I've entered with clients into a civil compromise of this kind of thing whereby some kind of restitution to the shop owner has resulted in an agreement that stands up in court for the dropping of the criminal charge because it's been settled civilly. Do you intend for this in any way to interfere with that other procedure?
No, and Representative Smith, I recall that in the Senate committee and the testimony of the Attorney General of the State of Washington, Mr. Slade Gorton, a question arose of this nature, and I believe I can paraphrase it properly, that there is a tendency noted in the State of Washington for district attorneys not to prosecute criminally in some cases when there has been a civil procedure instituted.
Sure, savings. Maybe we ought to refer this to ways and means to show us savings.
Yeah. For the
may I add one comment to that? I think I should say that both the Attorney General of the State of Washington and my counterpart, Mr. Bill Robinson, Director of the Washington Retail Council, reported to us that demand letters are effective in from 70% to 80% of the cases in the state of Washington.
One more question. The demand, the form of the demand letter, and this may be more appropriately directed at one of my colleagues here than yourself, Representative,
Is that made clear then to the recipient of the demand letter that they have the choice of paying or going to court?
That's what a demand letter is.
I mean, I just want to make sure that when you do that.
In this booklet that was supplied to you in a large stack of information is a copy of the demand letter in the use of the state of Washington. The form of the letter is not prescribed by statute, but this is one they have used now for 2 years very successfully. Would you care to look at it, Representative Cohen?
Mr. Chairman.
As long as we're on subsection 6 on page 2, I'd like to know if there was ever a discussion that the written letter should be a condition precedent to bringing the civil action in somewhat the same way that we have provisions for attorney's fees awards based upon a previous demand letter at least 10 days prior to filing suit, and whether it shouldn't be mandatory rather than permissive.
Well, we've followed the procedure that has been used in the state of Washington because they were having success with it. In an educational process, which will be our responsibility, I'm sure, with the retail community, that is a necessary element, that the demand letter not be presented at the time of the apprehension, but 24 hours or more later, and that it be mailed to the recipient. And that if a response is not forthcoming, then a second letter is sent reminding them of the obligation. And that if response is not forthcoming, that retailers uniformly prosecute in the civil court. Because if they do not, there will be no leverage to the law. If it is found that all you have to do is resist a little bit and nothing is done, we'll be right where we are today. Nothing happens. It is the certainty of the penalty that is essential.
Well, I don't know that Representative Cohen was going to follow this up when she returned, but I know that one of the discussions that I had with Joan and I think Representative Cohen prior to the hearing this afternoon was the nature of the letter, which may be misleading to a layperson who assumes that they have only one option to escape going to court, and that is to pay money, and that they may do that necessarily even though they think they have a valid defense. And it's an implication that if it's in the statute that the retailer can merely send a letter and seek this money, that has the force of law, and therefore they must pay the money, even though it's a disputed claim.
Well, it cannot be used as a threat. They have the recipient of the letter has the option, of course, of not paying and going to court. If it were used as a threat, it would be, I presume, in legal terms, an extortion.
Is there further discussion? Representative Buchanan.
Just one quick question. If under the Section 2 parents, and we've stricken legal guardian, you have a situation where a person has adopted the children of a spouse to which he is presently allied, or she is presently married, and there is a conservatorship or trust, let's say, that is left. Let's say the parents of the children has either deceased, either died, or in some fashion provided in a trust for that for those children. What do you practitioners say? Is it the responsibility of the parent to pay of his own earnings, or can the trust be tapped for the responsibility?
I don't think I'm the one to answer that question.
Yeah, it's really more to somebody on the panel.
Representative Mason, the question.
depends on the trust itself. There's a real complicated law regarding spendthrift trusts, whether or not trusts are vulnerable, and I don't know whether Representative Smith's done any of it, but it can be a real morass. Mainly on the nature of the trust, if I remember right.
If it's a spendthrift trust, the only thing you could really attach on to would be the money coming out of the
trust
that was stored to the person. Once it gets into his hands, then it would be attachable. So further discussion.
I might just add that it seems to me that if you made a claim against the conservatorship, that the conservator would have to disallow the claim, at which point you would have the right to go in and have the claim heard under the probate provision. So.
Good luck.
Okay. Further discussion on the motion. The motion is to send Senate Bill 893 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Nope.
Aye.
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 Aye. Passes. Okay, one more to go. Let's take a 5-minute break.
There's 3:30 session.
And we are excused for business of the House subject to a call. I'd like to try to deal with the last bill. I think we probably deal with what, 10 minutes, 15 minutes?
I don't know.
We'll see. Yeah, there's cake in here at...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, right on.
So we will be in recess in 10 minutes. We're going to come to order. The clerk will note those members present. The House are excused. Next item on the agenda for work session, Senate Bill 356. Yes?
Okay, I've got a number of things to hand out on this.
Goodness. You have the AFL-CIO remarks?
Yeah.
They have some.
No, there is.
Yeah. But you're making that up.
I don't have a copy to hand out. I'll just describe those if you get to that point.
Definition.
I think that you probably want to go with the bill that was sent to us by Pat Horton from Eugene, and that's the Xerox, which includes the original bill and then has deletions and additions, amendments. So I would imagine that's the bill you want to work on. I'll start by saying that Mr. Horton's bill did not come from Senate Judiciary, and you'll see that as I go through it, everything that implies. It has considerable problems, but there may be a kernel within it that you would wish to pass up. The way I think to analyze the bill is to try to think of hypotheticals which would constitute the crime or crimes, and I'll give you some examples of those. And that may help you in winnowing it down. It's late, and if we can just make some progress on it, that may be enough to satisfy it for today. A person commits the crime of using a child in sexual performance if he knowingly employs, authorizes, or induces a child under 16 years of age to engage in a sexual performance. I think right there, it'd probably be worthwhile to go down and see what sexual performance means. So on line 17 and below, sexual performance means a play, motion picture, photograph, dance, show, or other presentation, whether depicted, animated, or live, which in whole or in part depicts or reveals the child's genitals with the intent of arousing sexual desire of the child or another person. Or sadomasochistic abuse as defined in the definitions that I passed out, sexual conduct as defined in the definitions that I passed out, sexual excitement, as so defined, or presentations which include obscenities, as defined, or explicit verbal descriptions or narrative accounts of sexual conduct. The bill degenerates as it goes, so. I don't mean that.
Play on words,
yeah. Let's go back up to the first page, lines 10 to 11. He commits the crime against being a parent or legal guardian of a child under 16, consents to the participation by the child in a sexual performance. Just stopping there for a moment, I'm not well enough versed in guardianship law or vicarious liability criminal law to know off the top of my head the whole implications of that, but consenting to the conduct of another being a crime is rather unprecedented, I think, but we could use some more research on that. Produces, directs, aids, or facilitates a sexual performance by a child. Okay, so you got three different ways of committing the crime. The first definition, sexual performance means a play, motion picture, photograph, dance, show, or other presentation, whether depicted, animated, or live, which in whole or in part depicts or reveals the child's genitals with the intention of arousing sexual desire of the child or another person. We might want to come back to that, but that sounds, at least on its face, like something pretty bad. I think we'll take some analysis, but it doesn't jump right out at me as being something that is something we should condone. Sadomasochistic abuse. Let's look at that for a second. Well, the definition is there in front of you. At the bottom of the definitions I handed out. So, to read that, it means sexual performance means sadomasochistic abuse. So if you employ, authorized, or induced a child to engage in sadomasochistic abuse, that would be covered by the law. Or if you were the parent of a child and you consented to engaging in that, or if you produced, aided, or facilitated sadomasochistic abuse. Now you realize that the way the bill is structured, it wouldn't be a show of sadomasochistic abuse, it would be the abuse itself. So you may want to, I'm not quite clear what the bill is doing, but or what it intends to do, I assume that you want to make the performance of the abuse criminal, not the abuse itself, because the abuse itself would already be a crime. I would have, but at any, at this point, am I right or am I wrong? The way it's worded, if the child engaged in the sadomasochistic abuse, that would be criminal, but that's already criminal. So trying to read into what Mr. Horton has submitted to us, it could be that he wants to make using a child in a play or a movie which contains sadomasochistic abuse a crime. Shall we go on?
Yes. Then are you saying that it's, that you'd already be an accomplice to a crime if you indeed did that?
Well, it's against the law to engage in sadomasochistic abuse.
The only possible defense would be that we really weren't engaging in sadomasochistic abuse. We were just play acting, therefore.
Well, what I think is I think Mr. Horton's got his words in the wrong place. I think what he means to say is that a sexual performance is a performance of sadomasochistic abuse for an audience or somebody, but not that it is the same thing as sadomasochistic abuse. I'll go on. Sexual performance means sexual conduct. So, sexual conduct means, you can read it, but I'll pick one out for you. Sexual conduct means touching of the breast of a female, whether alone or between members of the same or opposite sex, in an act of apparent stimulation or gratification, or touching the genital areas of a human male or female. I'd like to give the example of the play Equus. Now, I believe the star of the play Equus is older than 16, but there's no reason why the same play about the troubled teenage boy who, maybe you're familiar with it, maybe you're not, commits cruelty to horses by plucking out their eyes in a sort of a frenzy. There's no reason why that child couldn't have been 13 or 14 for purposes of the story. And during the play, which I saw and which was nominated for the Academy Award and which won awards all over the place, part of his development and the development of his own trauma was that at times he would touch his own body because what was going on was his own shame about going through puberty. It was a serious depiction of the trials and tribulations of growing up. And it says here that if sexual conduct were performed by a child under 16, which could very easily happen in the most reputable theater company in any community in the state, that would be a crime. So that's an example of how the bill overreaches.
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, if I can, I think we get in the language of Mr. Horton in this draft, down around line 19 through 23. It seems to me like we're really getting into the First Amendment problem. I just can't believe.
Right on the fringes of it out there.
The way it was originally existed, it was closer to what we might get away with passing than something like this.
Before I take any more questions or comments from members, I've just been handed a note that says that we're needed on the floor. And my intention is to carry this over to place it at the top of the agenda, the next opportunity for a full committee work session. I'd like to have members take a look at the proposed amendments and the bill and work with staff to see if we can develop some language to get the bill out.
Ideas or comments on the work
Chairman,
first
and foremost, could you call Pat Horton and find out? He and I talked briefly a couple nights ago, and it was his feeling that this draft, whether he agrees or not, was tighter and presented fewer constitutional problems than the way the bill came to the Senate.
I'll be glad to call him, although, well, that's not true, but I'll call him.
What do you think? What do you think, Dave?
I haven't really had a chance to study it yet. This is the first
looks
time.
Looks like the
opposite. Richard? I would like to sex neutralize this bill.
Well, that's fine. That's
no problem.
AFL-CIO does probably contact many of you. They do have a problem with last section of the bill.
Tell me how you
That's
coming before the committee. If not, we're sure.
That's why there are a number of movies that would.